Welcome to Dialogue, a true crime conversation. I'm your host, Rebecca Sebastian, coming to you quarantined from New York City. These are crazy times. I think I'm not going to overdo any corona talk. I know we're all in it, and the headlines are relentless, and the texts, and the posts, and the chatter. I'm right here with all of you. My anxiety is high. I am trying to combat it, and sometimes that looks like not striving, but breathing, and I'm trying to be a little more physical than I usually am. Definitely getting fresh air alone in safe distances from other people. And yeah, everything is changing, and that is really real. The nice thing is podcasts can go on fairly uninterrupted, because this is always a pretty remote way of communicating with other people, which is pretty cool. So I'm really glad that I've had no cancellations. In fact, because I now work from home, perhaps I'll have a little more bandwidth or margin to produce extra content. I don't know. That's a goal, but it's too early to say. Trying to find my new normal with kids home and my work life still happening, just happening at home. And I'm really thankful for my job and the ability to work remotely and to continue podcasting. I know there are many, many others who don't have that situation, and my heart truly goes out to them. I'm making small donations to venues that are closed because of this, including Caveat New York City, where I've done Yellow Tape, a true crime trivia show, including QED Astoria, where I've also done my trivia show, and there's so many others. Looking out for the small businesses in my neighborhood that are still open. And I just encourage you all to do whatever you can in this weird time for people who are in the service industry, the gig industry, cafes and restaurants, servers, bartenders. It's just so fragile right now. And if you're one of the people who can lend a helping hand, I know now is absolutely the time. And so let me think if there's some announcements before I get to today's guest, which is one I've been courting her, you could say, for many months. So this is very exciting for me. But before that, let me just say that my trivia show, Yellow Tape, was canceled. I had a March 22nd show planned live in New York City. That is obviously not happening. But I've been talking to the owners of the venue, and they have started live streaming their shows from remote locations of the performers. So I've decided now is the time to be technologically experimental, I suppose. I just thought of that phrase as I said it. And I'm going to give it a go. So Sunday night, March 22nd at 7 p.m. Eastern, I will be live streaming my Yellow Tape, a true crime trivia show. So I don't exactly know how you log into that yet. They're going to send me a link later tonight, and I'll be posting that on social media. So if you don't follow me yet, go to @dialoguepod, or my Yellow Tape trivia Instagram feed is @yellowtape_truecrime. I will put both of these in the show notes. You can also go on Facebook @dialoguepod. I'll put it there. And let's try that. Maybe that'll be a really super 21st century way to hang out together. Talk true crime. I'll ask some questions. You'll see if you have the answer. I think people are going to be able to type in their answers in real time, and I'll get to see who's kind of winning, quote unquote. And I don't know, it'll be different and it'll be fun, and I'm excited to try it. So by then, I think I'm going to be desperate for some human connection other than my family, if you know what I mean. So I hope to, quote unquote, see you all there. I think we can get into today's episode, which is episode 35. My episodes are slowly creeping up to my age, which is wild. It'll be fun when they get older than me. And my guest today is Rebecca Heath. Fun fact, her name is spelled just like mine with a K-A-H. Can't tell you how rare that is and how cool it was to connect with her. I have been low-key stalking her on LinkedIn, asking her if she'd be willing to speak with me. If you recognize her name, you'll know she's the librarian who was instrumental in identifying three of the four victims found in the Bear Brook case in New Hampshire. If you haven't yet heard her story, I cannot wait for you to hear this interview. You will hear all about it. And if you do know the case, and if you've listened to Bear Brook, then you're going to get really amazing personal insight from a woman who was just in the center of this story and kind of became an overnight citizen detective sensation, though it wasn't overnight at all. You're going to hear how she'd been researching for years and how her hobby slash obsession, her words, turned into really valuable information for law enforcement. Rebecca Heath will be at CrimeCon speaking about this, being a citizen detective, speaking about this case. And you will also find her this coming Friday night on 2020. There is a 2-hour special. So whatever time 2020 is on, I think it's 8 o'clock, 7 central, there's a 2-hour special. Rebecca Heath will be featured in that, and it's all about the Bear Brook murders. So it's a perfect time for this interview to come out. I'm so glad it worked out. I'm really grateful for her time and that we were able to connect. Before we go into the interview, I am going to read a brief overview of Terry Rasmussen, who is the perpetrator in this case, because it's a little bit confusing and we don't do a deep dive timeline on the case. So I think it might be helpful for you all to hear just a brief overview of the bodies we're talking about, the four women, and Terry Rasmussen himself. And this was researched and prepared for me by Patty, who helped me with the Fort Worth Trio and does some help for me on social media. So thank you again to Patty for this. I'm going to read this brief commentary and then get right into my interview with Rebecca Heath. Stay safe, stay healthy. Please DM me on Instagram or Facebook if you need to talk and connect. I would be happy to be there for you. Until then, let's just kill the small talk. At different points in time, Terry Rasmussen was known by different aliases, such as Bob Evans, Curtis Mayo Kimball, Gordon Jensen, Larry Vanner, and Jerry Mockerman. This fact has earned him the moniker the Chameleon Killer. Rasmussen has been known to live in a number of states, including Colorado, Idaho, Virginia, Texas, Oregon, Hawaii, and California, before eventually settling in New Hampshire. In 1978, Rasmussen began dating Marlise Honeychurch. Marlise was last seen in California at a Thanksgiving dinner with family. She showed up with Rasmussen and her two daughters, Marie Vaughn and Sarah McWaters. In 1985, a barrel was found in Bear Brook State Park in Allenstown, New Hampshire. The barrel contained the remains of Marlise and Marie. In 2000, a second barrel was discovered about 100 yards from where the first barrel was found. The second barrel contained the remains of Sarah and an unidentified child between the age of 2 and 4 years old. Even though investigators have been unable to identify the third child, DNA testing done in 2019 revealed that the child belonged to Terry Rasmussen. Rasmussen was also linked to the disappearance of Denise Bowden and her 6-month-old daughter sometime after Thanksgiving in 1981. Investigators believe that Rasmussen killed her, although her body has never been found. Rasmussen remained in possession of Denise's daughter until 1986, at which time he abandoned the child. He was sentenced to 18 months in jail for child abandonment. In June 2002, Rasmussen's common-law wife, Yun Sun Jun, went missing. Rasmussen was arrested in November and in 2003 pled no contest to charges in relation to Yun Sun's murder and dismemberment. He was sentenced to 15 years to life and died in prison in 2010. What makes this case particularly strange and compelling is the perpetrator, the murder, was known. The victims were not. It was working a case almost completely backwards from how we normally do. Now you'll hear from Rebecca Heath and her involvement in the case. Rebecca, thank you so much for being on Dialogue, a true crime conversation. This has been a long time coming, and I'm glad it's finally here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. Before we get into the very specific why I invited you, which a lot of our guests will probably understand from the intro and from knowing your story and listening to Bear Brook, I wondered if you could just take me back and take our listeners back. Was true crime and mystery on your radar as a child or in adolescence? Like, what do you first remember in that sphere?
True crime, I would say true crime. No, it wasn't part of my thought process as a child. I don't think the so-called obsession with true crime started until probably it was like in my, I want to say mid-20s, which I think kind of fits that the demographic for young women that seem to
Definitely.
be obsessed with it.
And was it a specific case, or just did you become aware in some way of a trial or a case, or was it just entertainment?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure what pulled me into true crime specifically, but for me, it was more cases that dealt with unidentified victims, the Jane Does, just because of my own life circumstances and what my past was. I saw a relatability part of it. I saw that I could have become or could have been one of these Jane Does because of my life circumstance.
Wow.
To just give you like a little summary, when I was 19, I made a huge decision to walk away from a life that was everything was pretty much told how and when and what I could do. I walked away from a religious cult, and my entire family was in it, like brothers, sisters, parents, grandparents. And when I walked away from that, I was just so vulnerable, so absolutely impressionable. And walking into this new world, and I say that in air quotes, walking into this different life, I had so much to learn and catch up on and kind of just learn the ins and outs. And I made it. I survived it. I didn't go down the path of turning to addiction or turning to, trying to numb pain, or whatever in that sense. And looking back now, I see how lucky I really was. There were certainly circumstances that I could have come across dangerous individuals, or I could have come in contact with them. And if something had happened to me, I would have become one of these Jane Does. I would have become a victim. I wouldn't have family looking for me. I wouldn't have anyone identifying me. So that's what initially pulled me into those cases. A part of me really just wanted to be a voice for them, seeing that I saw that I could have been one.
Wow, I did not know that part of your story, and thank you so much for sharing it. My second interview on Dialogue was with a cult survivor and escapee. She escaped the Children of God cult. And so I only know an inkling of what that experience is through her story, but I know how all-encompassing it is because you really, when you step out, you have to leave everything behind. You have no support system, usually no livelihood. So to know where you are now and what you've accomplished and your work, it was remarkable and impressive to me already, but now it's like tenfold. So that's incredible. And so you sort of used that place of vulnerability to fuel this interest or this intrigue around missing persons cases and victims without identities. That's fascinating to me and a really, really kind of beautiful motive, actually.
Yeah, I don't think if I thought about when I was doing it, I don't think I wouldn't have said, oh, the reason I'm doing this is because I am trying to, like, I wouldn't be able to voice that. It was really kind of a
Yeah.
subconscious, it was a way to escape. It was a way to kind of, I don't know, I just almost give these other people a second chance, just because they had maybe made a bad decision or came into contact with someone that, I don't know, I don't think it all came full circle for me until it all happened
Came full circle.
Then it really became clear.
Yeah, I think so much of the things we do, we don't know our motives. A lot of them are under the surface. I think we're kind of just following some instincts. And gosh, I've quoted this on this podcast an embarrassing number of times, but Elizabeth Gilbert, the writer, says, follow your curiosity as opposed to following your passion. Sounds like you just followed this curiosity, and maybe it was an attempt even to control's probably the wrong word, but even to repair some things that had happened to you, to help another who was not helped and who was left alone. There's probably like some service you were doing to yourself in some way. But again, I'm not an expert.
No, I com no, I completely agree. I recall giving an interview to somebody, and it kind of hit as I was talking, and it was like, oh my goodness, like it was, it did, you don't, you didn't realize, I didn't realize up until that point, oh my goodness. But when I was looking for the identity of these girls, I truly found my own
Wow.
identity. And it seems so like poetic or something that you would make up, but it that really, really is, it's genuinely what happened.
So it sort of becomes the story within the story. You know,
It
like
does.
you were just setting out to do this thing kind of externally outside of you, and then all of a sudden there you are in the center of it. And that's pretty amazing. So let's talk about that a little bit. What exactly you were doing? There's this case of Terry Rasmussen. So at this point, it's just was your interests to sort of scour these missing persons boards and cases and forums. And I know to some people that sounds weird, but I think to my audience and a lot of true crime people, it actually doesn't. I think a lot of our brains work that way. So you're in a very safe space here. But can you talk about that time in your life, what it looked like and what you actually did?
Well, where I would start with, I guess I would start with, so the first time I came across this case was probably about 10 years ago, and I recall thinking that that's crazy that no one knows who any of these individuals are. And I remember looking, because I had seen it in like a newspaper article that was from an archive. And I thought, oh, well, that's got to be solved by now. When I looked at it, it still wasn't. And that was mind-boggling to me that there was an essentially an entire family that was a mother, and she had, they assumed that these two little girls that were found with her were related to her, and then there was another little girl with them.
Right.
And it seemed, how, like, that's like a whole family. You don't really have, I don't know of any other cases where you have pretty much a whole family that's unidentified.
Yeah.
So that stood out to me. The case always was interesting to me. I would find any way to bring up this case in conversation. It's kind of embarrassing, but I truly, I think there's something about it that I always kind of felt like, oh, I'm gonna find out somehow, like that I'm like connected to this case, that I thought of it as like, oh, I'm gonna find out I'm like related or something
Oh,
like that.
interesting.
But it turns out, no, it wasn't that I was related to them. I ended up, playing a role in helping assist identify them.
Right. So what did you know, like, about Terry Rasmussen at that point? Because is it true they kind of had him as the killer, and it was just sort of a matter of matching him to victims, which is weird.
True. So that brings, all right, so that brings it back. So I came across the case 10 years ago, and then it kind of just was dormant. There wasn't much happening. Then New Hampshire State Police came out with a press release saying, we think we know who the perpetrator is. We know him as Bob Evans.
Right.
And that was, I believe, 2016. And at that point, I got obsessed. That was when I truly got obsessed, because you knew the perpetrator, you didn't know the victims. And that's the opposite of how most.
Exactly.
It's like the opposite. So to me, I felt, well, we definitely have the answers. Like, there's no way we don't have the answers if it's unraveling backwards. So then that's when I got obsessed with it. And at some point, there was a podcast that came out on Bear Brook, and I had to listen to it because I was just so obsessed and needed to know every little detail.
Yeah.
I figured any new thing you come across, any new piece of like an article or anything on it could give me maybe a factoid or a tidbit that I didn't know. I'm getting ahead of myself though.
That's okay. I mean, that's a great place. So you listen to Bear Brook. So probably that comes out in 2017 or was it 16? Around there.
So I should have mentioned. So when the press release came out and said that he's Bob Evans, I really started researching into the case. That's when I really, really, really needed to cover like all bases, as I thought answers are right in front of us. I just have to find them.
Okay.
And that's when people kept commenting on this case, constantly saying, how is nobody looking for them? How is no one looking for them? And my thought was, no, somebody's looking for them. How do we find them? There's somebody looking. We just need to find that person. We need to connect the dots. So that's when I decided the best avenue would be to put myself in a loved one's position, like saying, where would I look? Where would I go if I was looking for someone missing?
Right.
And if you think of it, before really the internet was really widely available and used by the public, there were very few possibilities where somebody could start looking. So it would be like in newspaper articles, old newspaper articles, or very early on there was message boards. There still are, but there's a ton of people that post on
like a forum, a group or a forum.
I'm drawing a blank, but any type of message board they were much bigger than they are now.
That
people would post on them.
Sure.
So I started looking through those message boards, and I started compiling a list on my computer, and anytime I found a listing that seemed like it would fit either location, time, even the fact that there were girls, we knew little girls, and the mother, anything that fit in those categories, I just threw into this list. And I would go through this list one by one and try and rule out that this person could possibly be related, or that they were found.
So it's probably a good time to talk about what you were doing professionally at the time, because a lot of us consider ourselves, armchair or citizen detectives, whichever term you prefer, but not all of us have your methods of research, because that was your work, right? So maybe talk about what you're doing professionally at this time, and it clearly informs your investigation, which I'm prepared to call it that, because that feels like what it was. It was so organized, and you were very tenacious, but you had some real skills behind you to kind of fuel this investigation. So can you talk about your work?
Sure. So I work during the day as a librarian, and although I do have the label of librarian, I do like to kind of put out there that most people think of a librarian as having a master's degree and someone that is well trained in research, which generally they are. I only received this job title merely because of working so many years at the company and attaining that job title. But I do work with other women that do have master's degrees. So I still completely consider myself an armchair detective or a...
I think you're next level. You definitely graduated out of that.
Well, I don't like people to be scared by the label of, oh, well, it was a librarian, because it's kind of twofold that, yeah, that is my label. I do have that title, but I don't have a master's degree. I don't have that. I truly only gained that because of working so many years in this. So,
Well, that's fair. And I'm sure you don't want people to feel like, oh, I can't do this if I'm not a professional researcher or have a master's degree, right? It's equal opportunity. Everybody can play a part in this movement of citizen detective.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. That's definitely why I want to push that. It is not, don't think of it as, oh, it was somebody who had to receive, you know, this type of education. That's simply not true.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good clarification. But your skill set and your personality certainly complement this kind of work, would you say?
I would say for sure. My type of work, the line of work that I have, generally someone comes to a librarian because they can't find what's readily available, and you find it for them.
Right.
So that certainly played a role. I talked to my older bosses before they retired, and they will even say, you just wouldn't give up. It didn't matter if you were, they were like, stop, don't look anymore. Like, you've tried. I never wanted to give someone the answer of, I just couldn't find something.
Right.
No matter what, I always wanted to find something. So I guess there was a little bit of a stubborn side to me that stuck through.
Yeah, a stubborn tenacity. I mean, that's kind of what it takes, because I find, you know, these things don't happen quickly. You know, there's cases, I was just at CrowdSolve, and it's a 1981 case. I mean, you just never know how all the things working together will lead to a breakthrough. But it's usually not fast, right? So so patience and persistence, and yeah, if that means stubborn, that's kind of what's required. So, okay, so now we understand what you were doing by day, and then by night you were probably organizing your spreadsheet on your computer, cross-referencing these identities and trying to find a living connection who could claim them. Is that sort of basically your MO, your objective?
Yeah, I think that would summarize it. Just, literally picture me sitting on the couch in my sweats with my laptop. That's as intense as it gets.
Yeah, well, no, that's the dream. I mean, that's like all of us. As soon as we can just get in our comfy place, our comfy clothes, and do what we love to do on the internet, that's like, you know, the dream. So Bear Brook comes out, and you're listening, and then what starts to happen and connect in your mind?
New Hampshire State Police made that statement about Bob Evans. At that point, I had come across a listing from an ancestry message board that seemed like it was a possible match, because from the information that was given in the press release, we knew that these two little girls were maternally related. We didn't know if they were the mother of the adult female, but it was assumed it was either the mother or an older sister.
Okay.
So I knew I should be looking for, that these sisters could be maternally related, but their father, the paternal side, might not match. So they would have different fathers. So I took that into consideration with searches. And when I started using terms, I would look for terms that would include stepsister, half sister, just because of there were two little girls that weren't related. I assumed that there had to be more, like if somebody was searching for them, maybe they could be like, oh, I'm looking for half sisters, or I'm looking for stepsisters, like
Yeah.
something that if somebody was searching, what terms they would use. And using those search terms, I came across a listing that a woman was looking for her husband's half sister, Sarah McWaters. And the time frame fit, the location fit. They mentioned California. It was around the, I want to say 77 to 79.
Okay.
And when I started looking into Sarah McWaters, I noticed that there were more family members that were looking for Sarah McWaters' mother, Marlise, and that she had another daughter, Marie.
Right.
So it really fit because, okay, these two girls are not paternally related. The age range fits. The age of the mother fits. So I threw it in a post on an online, like a Facebook group.
Right.
I said, does anyone think that this is them? And I didn't really receive any feedback. Nobody really kind of was like, oh yeah, it's them. So I kind of pushed it to the side and didn't really, it was still on the list, but I didn't pursue it.
Okay.
Then New Hampshire State Police comes out with a second press release saying the man we thought was Bob Evans, that was an alias, his true name is Terry Peter Rasmussen. And they gave his background, that, what he had left a family, and that we knew he was using this alias, Bob Evans. That is when the podcast came out on Bear Brook. And of course, I had to listen to it.
Yes.
And as I'm listening to it, the third episode starts covering isotopes. And they get very technical and scientific. And I'm just loving every second of it because
It's like really resonating with you.
I'm such a nerd. And I'm like writing down info. I'm stopping. I'm writing it down. I'm fast forwarding. I'm re rewinding. I looked back. I'm like, oh my goodness, I was crazy. But things were just clicking. Everything seemed like it was like lining up, and all of a sudden I'm like, you know what? That listing, that one listing, because I could never rule it out, and I would always go back to it and try and rule out, make sure these aren't the girls, make sure these aren't the girls. That podcast, I was like, you know what? No, nope. I'm contacting that woman. I'm finding her. I'm tracking her down, and I'm just like, this is. I'm going to be done with this once and for all to make sure that it's not them.
And you had not previously reached out to her. You had put it out to kind of a broader message board community, right?
Yes,
So this
yeah,
is
I
your
had.
first time going directly to her.
Yeah,
Okay,
yeah.
okay.
I had merely just thrown it in a post in a Facebook group
Okay.
that had followed the case.
Got it.
So I decide I'm driving home because I take night classes. I'm driving home from class, and I'm so determined. All I'm doing is I'm contacting that woman. It's just on my mind. I walk in the door, grab my laptop, and start searching. And this post was originally from 1999. So that's a long ways away. Most of the email addresses that are used are broken. That you can't contact the person that way. So I decided, well, I'm just going to try Facebook. Maybe she'll be on Facebook. So I found the person who I assumed it was and sent them a Facebook message. Mind you, this is like 9:30 at night. And I said, "Hey, are you the individual that was posting looking for ceramic waters?" And she wrote back, oh, I almost instantly.
Oh my gosh.
And she said, "Yeah, I am." She said, "You have my heart racing." And then I said, "Oh," and then I'm thinking to myself, "Oh my goodness, she thinks that I'm Sarah. Like she thinks
Oh
that I'm Sarah reaching out." And I said, "Oh God, I have
Gotta
to
get
just,
ahead of this.
yeah, no." It's like I'm just somebody that tries to help individuals looking for missing loved ones. Maybe I can help you. And so she just started kind of telling me the details of what happened. Ceramic Waters was with her mother, Marlise, and there was the other daughter, Marie. And I'm just asking very simple questions. I'm like, what color eyes did Sarah have? You know, what color hair? And she just throws in there a text. Oh, and by the way, Marlise or Marty, as she was going by, left with a guy and his name was Rasmussen.
Oh my gosh.
And I like the world really stopped. People say like everything stops around you. That's what happened. I stopped, I paused, I remember my hands just shaking uncontrollably. And I'm going, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God."
I mean, you must be now 99.9% sure. You're like, I've got this. Like,
No,
this is real.
at that point, I had no doubt in my mind. There was no doubt. I knew. I knew.
100%. Okay. Oh my
And
gosh.
I'm sitting behind my computer going, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my
You're like me and all the listeners right now.
It was, oh my God, still thinking about it, my heart starts racing. It's a feeling like you cannot even, I don't think I've ever had that feeling before. I don't think I ever experienced. It's a feeling of just complete disbelief. Nothing seems real. Everything around you seems slow motion. And I kept, I should mention that before this, I think I was so obsessed with it that it was actually getting in my dreams, and
Oh,
I
well, not
kept
surprised to hear this at all, actually.
I kept dreaming I was doing something on my computer, and I'd push one button, it was like, "Oh, it's solved, it's solved." And then I would wake up, and it was so frustrating. It was so frustrating because that happened two times before this. And then when this happened, I kept convincing myself, no, this is just a dream. Like,
Oh
it's
my
the dream
gosh.
again. It's the dream. I'm just gonna wake up and so that happened. It was
In actual reality.
it was very real. It was like I said, it was late at night, it was 9:30. You can't like call up law enforcement and start talking to people. I did not sleep. I could not sleep. I was so living on this whatever high that oh my God, this case is going to get some sort of closure.
So you managed to wait till the morning somehow.
somehow I made it through the next day. I don't know what
And what
to do.
department do you call? Do you call the New Hampshire State Police, or do you call out West? What's the
So for me, my first thought was I'm going to call San Bernardino, California,
Okay.
because I'm not actually sure. Why did I go? I guess because Terry was from there.
Yeah, that makes
So
sense.
I just assumed. So and I was doing this the next day. I had to like wait till I was through done with work, and I'm just like, oh my God, I can't do anything. I just gotta like I was going crazy. Then I finally get the chance. I'm like, okay, I got a call, and I call the wrong phone number. Apparently, there's a San Bernardino Police Department and a sheriff's department,
Oh, okay.
and they're like, no, you need to call the sheriff's department. And I was like, oh my God, like I just really want to talk to somebody. Like I can't, because
You're
it
like, I
was
have done a
like.
lot of work to get to this moment. Could you just patch me through?
Just get me there. So long story short, I get in touch with Peter Headley, who was looking over the case. And I'm like, I think you probably get this all the time. Somebody thinks they're giving you a tip to like something that's really gonna solve this case. But I truly, 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 truly think that this really will solve that, solve the case for you. And he kind of just like he laughs, like he gives like a like you're thinking in, to yourself. He's like, yeah, I've heard this before. Like
Right.
I got you, been there, done that. And but the more I started talking to him and telling him the details, I could tell that he was seeing the coincidences just as much as I was. The dates lined up. Everything just seemed to line up, and the fact that the woman had given his name Rasmussen freely, I did not bring it up. I certainly didn't bring up the case. It wasn't anything like that. This information was all just freely given.
Wait, I have a quick
That.
question. Did when she told you Rasmussen the name, was she unaware of the break in New Hampshire where they announced Bob Evans was an alias and we know his name was this?
Yeah,
Was she aware of that?
they so that side of the Sarah's side of the family and Marie's side of the family, no one was aware of the case at all. They had
Okay.
never ever come across it.
Got it. Got it. Okay. I figured if she was saying it like that without the weight and gravity around it, but just making sure. Okay,
No,
continue.
yeah.
Okay.
So, contacted California, and then at that point, I had been in contact with Marlise's siblings too, and a bunch of us got together and created a like kind of a secret group that we were kind of just going back and forth in, and people were sharing photos. So Marlise's siblings were getting DNA tests that next week, and then Sarah McWhorter's half brother was also getting DNA tests in New Hampshire by the next week. So they were
Oh.
taking it seriously.
Who
So
is keeping you apprised of the case activity?
at that point, I was hearing about it through the family. New Hampshire, I had spoken to them after Headley had passed it along, and that because it was in the jurisdiction, it was New Hampshire's case.
Okay.
So they called me, interviewed me, asked me. They're like, oh, could you explain how you found this? And so I tried explaining it.
How much time do you have, officer?
I truly didn't realize how odd and peculiar it seemed to spend countless hours looking for missing persons until I was explaining this story of how I found it to law enforcement. They're like, so you just do this as a hobby? And it's like, I guess.
Amazing. Oh my gosh. I love picturing that moment. I really do. Where they're like, "Do you want a job here?"
No, they actually did ask me at one point, "Are you related to Terry Rasmussen?" I was like, "No, I don't. No, I have no inside knowledge of this case. This is completely, like this. I don't know anyone involved. This is
This is just a voluntary niche interest.
I'm just a nobody that likes to look into this stuff."
Right. Yeah. Like, welcome to the club. Little do they know, there's thousands of us. Okay, so they're getting DNA tested. Things are moving. What time period are we talking about? How much time is passing?
Let's see, that happened in October of 2018. Now, at that point, the family is aware of the case because obviously they start asking questions of why, wait, why are we looking for them? Why? What? So they start reading stories. Sadly, that part of it really breaks my heart that they're going to search, they're going to do their own research, and they're assuming that these are their loved ones. Nobody really doubted. I don't think you just were waiting for the official word, but I don't think any family members doubted that this was them.
Right.
So at that point, we're going through a lot of it became very, very sad. It was, you have this high of, oh my, is this case is going to be solved. There's going to be closure, and then there's a huge weight. There's a huge weight. There's family members just constantly, did you hear anything else? Do you know it's them? Do you know? And asking these really in-depth questions that I couldn't answer. I didn't know. And that happened all the way until June of 2019. It took that long for DNA tests to come back.
Wow.
And the family was just, I mean, that's a long time. That's a long time
I
to
know
sit and wait.
it sure is. We forget that it doesn't happen, in that 1 hour episode like we're sometimes see. That's a really long time.
I mean, it's even longer than the normal, but there is still an on, I mean, there still is an ongoing, investigation. So it could be, it could have been much longer. But so at that point, Marlise's family, I knew they had gotten a call and that they were going to New Hampshire for a press release. So at that point, I knew, okay, this clearly is them. And they couldn't say anything though, but I knew they were coming to New Hampshire. So like, it wasn't hard to put two and two together at that point. New Hampshire State Police called me the night before and said, "Hey, that tip you gave us, we think you might want to tune in to a press release tomorrow."
Wow.
And that was the la I had never talked to them again since the last time I put the tip in. I hadn't heard anything from them. And I was like, "Oh, okay. Is this press release open to the
Yeah,
public?"
I was like,
And
please tell me you zoomed on over there.
like, "Can I come to this?" And they're like, "Oh, do you want to be a part of it?" And I was like, absolutely. Yes, I would." And they said, "Well, we're going to keep you anonymous in the press release. We're just going to call you a professional researcher." And I was like, "You know what? I kind of would prefer that you would at least call me a librarian, because I felt like professional researchers sound like I worked for the state police, and
Yeah, and that
I
you do
really,
this for a living.
yeah, and I didn't want, I didn't Not there to be any confusion that I was like, no, I think people really need to know that I was a nobody. I was literally somebody that sat on my couch and did this. I wasn't trained for this. So I said, yeah, I prefer if you said my name and if you say I'm a librarian. And
Good for you.
yeah, so I showed up and it they did make that announcement.
That is huge. I'm just taking it all in. Like that roller
It's
coaster of an experience, you know?
a
Yeah,
lot of
just
information.
it's a lot of information and it was such a long journey for you, right? So you're kind of doggedly following this case, putting these pieces together, and that's kind of the slow and monotonous part. And then you had little upticks of interest and intrigue, and then the phone call with the woman out west, that elation of feeling like, oh my gosh, this could be happening. But then the gravity of the identification means it's true, and the reality of that for that family, and all that that brings, you know, it's just so much to kind of bear witness to. I imagine that would just be a very overwhelming.
It was very, I think the word that comes to me is intense. It was
Yeah.
much, much different than I was expecting. I had become very close to these what were Jane Does. They had spent almost what, 2 2.5 years every single day with me, where I'm like searching and searching and searching and searching. And so there was this weird sense of letting them go. And but I felt like they had been with me with, you know, through so such a long time. Like clearly they had not been with me, but they had been on my mind. They had been such a part of my life that I don't know if I realized how attached I had gotten. And then seeing and meeting the family members at the press release, that made it really, really a reality of what the family members deal with. It's that part is really, it's really hard for me to, I guess, come to terms with, because there's almost a guilt there that you feel like you let them know about this information that would they have, you know, been better off not having to deal with that type of information. That's like, you don't know where your siblings are, and then you find out what happened, and it's horrible. It's nobody should have to figure that out. So it comes, it's there's highs, but there's really this kind of lows of seeing how people have to deal with it, and that's pretty heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's complex, no doubt. It isn't, you know, all one thing or another. It's not a happy ending in a traditional sense. You
Not at
know,
all.
there's closure, but there's so much wreckage that I'm sure the family has to deal with. But, and I know it might be hard for you to see because you're so close to it, but from where I sit, I'm thinking, what a gift you gave them. I mean, these nameless women for so long got their names back, their identity, their connection back to the people who've never forgotten them. I mean, I'd have to think as a family member that's at least in part how they view it, which is so powerful. It's kind of crazy.
It's true. I if I look back and say, well, where do I find contentment? Where do I find something that makes me feel at ease? And it truly is, I've always just looked for identities for them. I wanted names for the
Yeah.
victims. I didn't want them to be Jane Does. They deserved names. They have them now. They're Marlise and Sarah and Marie. That they've got that little ounce of dignity back,
Yes.
and I feel like there's maybe some sort of weird, I don't know, twist that there was a man that was preying on very vulnerable women and young children, and that somebody that had come through that path had kind of switched it and helped give them identity, which Terry Rasmussen worked so hard to hide and make them a non-identity.
Yes. It's incredibly powerful. It really is. And to me it's one of the most positive and redemptive things that I see coming out of true crime is people like you who are whether you intended to be or not, kind of in this genre. I mean, now you're looked to kind of as this patron saint of citizen detective work, and you're going to speak at CrimeCon. But what you're doing is what you're speaking to. It's giving a voice back to the voiceless. It's seeking truth and justice, and it's doing it in a very unglamorous, slow, in the background kind of way. And it's very encouraging to me that that's the kind of good and that's the kind of beauty that can come out of this, because some of it, it's such dark subject matter, murder and cold cases and missing persons. These things don't end well, and it's dark. And there's just some light when you can give back those three girls and the women what was taken from them in some small way. Not everything, but just their name, just that, just not being anonymous. It's huge. It's huge.
Yeah, there. I feel like I should mention that one of the little girls that was found in the barrels is still not yet identified.
I wanted to talk about that. Yeah, there was a fourth. And
Yeah.
so is there any updates that you know of, or why is it she was just unrelated? We don't know.
So the information that we do have on the fourth victim is that she was biologically related to the serial killer. So
Okay.
we know that she's paternally related to Terry Rasmussen. That is her father. Unfortunately, we do not have her maternal line yet.
Okay.
I know that Barbara Rae Venter is looking into, like she's trying to find the build the tree and kind of figure out who her mother is.
Amazing.
Yeah, I mean, she's done a lot of work on this case. She identified who Terry was. So I know that she's working on it, and I mean, at the same time, I can't not look in the same fashion that I've looked for the others, because I feel like there's this huge obligation to her. She's the one that is just labeled serial killer's daughter, and I absolutely hate that. I hate that because she's an innocent baby. She's a child. She deserves her name, and so I look all the time and try and find something on her too. Somebody's gonna figure out something. There's just it's just a matter of time, you know.
Yeah, it feels like it must be solvable. It's just, it feels so close. So that's really good for our listeners to hear that that's still open-ended. And we definitely want to keep our eye on that and for movement in the case for
Absolutely.
her identity. So how did things change after this? The press release happens, or the press conference happens, you attend, you're identified, and I would imagine it's been quite a whirlwind since then.
It really has. I feel like my life was completely just turned upside down. By nature, I'm an introvert. I'm somebody that kind of keeps to myself. I don't. I'm not somebody that's like, oh, put the spotlight on me. And this experience has really forced me to get outside of my comfort zone. It has really forced me to focus on the positives, like from my own experience. what seemed like the worst thing that could ever possibly happen to me, and that, oh, poor me. It switched to, no, you're a survivor, and you can use your story to help others. And then this having this case, I didn't even realize that the significance of what happened, and it's crazy. I feel like I was building my own identity, helping these women and this woman and these girls find theirs.
Yeah.
So it's been life changing, 100%. I felt like there was a passion there, and I should be following my passion. And so it's really questioned my career and where I should go to next. Like you said, I'm speaking at CrimeCon. I would have never in a million years, if you had asked me before this was all happening, where do you see yourself? I certainly didn't see myself here, but I
You wouldn't have
feel
said headlining at CrimeCon 2020.
not standing in front of people and talking would probably not have been one of them. But I think the important part to me with all of this is that there's hope for like I feel like there's a couple of pieces, but if you feel like your life is not going the way you want and that you can't go outside of what's comfortable to you or you're afraid to, I think that my story is proof that you truly can find positive things and you can find supportive people. And there's another side that individuals that are looking for missing persons, they're looking for loved ones, they don't know where they are, to not give up hope, because there are people that maybe are working behind the scenes and you just don't know. You don't know what's ahead. And then the third is kind of the whole web sleuth armchair detective community, which I certainly identify with.
I'd say so.
It's you can make a difference. Anyone can make a difference. You can make such a huge difference, and you do not need to be in the spotlight. You don't need to be putting the attention on you. If you're doing it for the right reasons, I truly think that makes a huge difference. If you're doing it because you want names, or that you're doing it for not any reason to get any, notoriety or publicity, that if your intentions are true, I think you can make a huge difference.
Yeah, and to your first point, I'm thinking about how coming out of the experience you did as a young adult, having to forge your own path after what you experienced, you had different choices and you went very outward in helping others. And I always think about sometimes people in hard, I'll just speak for myself, like when I'm in a very kind of, I suffer from depression and I can go very inward, and it tends to be the advice I've gotten from other people is to kind of help others in those dark moments, and to when you're feeling the kind of the most sorry for yourself or the most confused or not sure what to do, who can you serve? Who can you look for? Who someone's got it worse, right? Always. So that's really hard advice, but it's really I've found it to be really helpful for me. But I just think it's remarkable that you kind of you I don't think you even were conscious of it, but you delved into this place of service for others, others who would never be able to thank you, others who didn't know what you were doing. But that was sort of an interesting direction for you, all things considered, of what you could have done. And so that, just to add on to what you're saying to people, to hear that and to encourage you to get outside yourself sometimes by looking up and seeing those around us who you can help. And for some people, that tug is going to be for missing persons. For other people, it's going to be the incarcerated, or, you know, there's so many different populations we can help. It's kind of, everybody has their own, what they're connected to, you know, or what resonates with them in their heart. But you're such an inspiring example of that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, I mean it. And I stalked you on LinkedIn for a while to tell you that. So I'm really glad I finally, I was almost as tenacious as you were finding the identities of these victims and trying to get you to be on my podcast. So thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Before I let you go, I do ask all my guests before they go, what is keeping you up at night? There's a lot right now.
I would say what keeps me up at night, and what usually keeps me up at night, is research. It's that one thing that I tell myself, okay, it's super late. You have to get to bed. You gotta wake up at 5:30. Like, you,
oh my gosh, like, that's an early morning.
Yeah. Go to bed. But the other side is, but you could just be one click away from finding the answer. You could just be 1 second away from finding the answer. Come on. Like, you don't know. You don't know. So it's for me, it's telling my brain, no, you need to shut down and rest and recoup and start again.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, your brain does need to recharge, and like sometimes just fresh eyes and a tired brain really help. But I mean, it's infecting your dreams, like you said, like you were dreaming about it. So yeah, you probably need a little cutoff time. You need a curfew, Rebecca.
It definitely is. There's something to be getting obsessed, but it's very true that you can't just keep doing it. You have to truly step back and say, okay, you know what? I still have to have a social life. I still need to, like, you can't let it take over your life.
Right.
You'll start seeing things differently once you come back to it and start looking at things again.
Yeah. And you'll be of no use to anybody if this smothers you or, you know, overwhelms you to debilitation. Like, then you can't help anybody. So that's good advice. Well, Rebecca, thank you so much. I can't wait to hear you at CrimeCon. I look forward to meeting you in person.
Well, thank you. I know this is one of my dreams was to go to CrimeCon. I never thought I would be a part of it, but that is just amazing. That's amazing to be, you know, included. So I look forward to it for sure.
Oh, likewise. It's so cool how that all transpired. So we will meet there, and thank you so much for being on Dialogue.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Dialogue, a true crime conversation. I'm your host, Rebecca Sebastian. If you're enjoying this show, would you go over to iTunes and leave me a quick rating and review? This will ensure the show gets to new listeners and we can keep making this show. Also, we are now on Instagram and Facebook, and you should follow along those true crime conversations as well, @DialoguePod. Kill the small talk, start a dialogue.